This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hospitality workwear and hotel and restaurant uniforms. Learn more at tilletnyc.com. Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's show is really fun. It's an interview with Chef Mashama Bailey and John O. Morisano, the duo behind The Gray and Gray Market in Savannah, Georgia. The Gray is actually located in a former Greyhound bus station that operated until 1964, which means it ran through the Jim Crow era and segregated black and white passengers. Today, this space is home to The Gray, which is one of the most celebrated restaurants in America, where Mashama is cooking dishes inspired by her upbringing in Savannah and Queens, New York. So Mashama has been the subject of an episode of Chef's Table on Netflix, which you should watch if you haven't. And this month, she won the James Beard Foundation Award for Best Chef Southeast. Jono has been at The Gray since the beginning. He's the founding partner and works front of the house in the restaurant occasionally. On a recent Friday afternoon, I met with both of them at Jono's Manhattan apartment near Gramercy Park. While we're talking, you're going to hear cabs going by. You're going to hear, I think a dump truck came by at some point. You're going to hear all of the New York sounds. And it was just a great afternoon where we drank wine and we talked about the pressures of running such a historic restaurant and what a business partnership between a black chef and a white co-founder looks like. Maybe it's because we weren't in the studio, or maybe it's because Mashama and Jono are so warm and personable, but the conversation is very intimate. You're going to hear that, and it shows how committed they are to The Gray. I think food critic Bill Addison put it best when he wrote this about The Gray in 2017. At a time when Southern cuisine has soaked up the limelight for at least the last 15 years, The Gray synthesizes much of what's relevant about this moment in American dining. It's an amalgamation of global and regional flavors, a big city chef making a seismic impact in a smaller town, and an acute awareness of and reckoning with complex racial, economic, and cultural histories. I really hope you like this episode, and thank you so much to Mashama and Jono. All right, so we are here. It's Friday. Having some rosé, some bubbles.
Some bubbles on a Friday.
Yes, and I'm so excited to be here with you two. And can you tell me about what the last 6 months have been like for both of you?
The last 6 months has been crazy. Really, right, Jono? Because we opened up The Gray Market about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And I have been trying to figure out how to balance my time between both spaces. And I must admit that initially, like, I'm there, but I'm not there every day like I'm there for The Gray. So there's a constant juggling act that's happening. And I don't know, like, who can relate, who has two jobs or chefs out there with more than one restaurant. Mm-hmm. I just want advice on how to balance that and also stay in tune with the team. So that for me, the last 6 months have been crazy for me with that. And also been writing.
Yeah.
And so throwing, you know, Jono and I are coming out with a book. It's the title-ish is going to be called White, Black, and the Gray.
Or Black, White, and the Gray.
Or Black, White, and the Gray. And so I'm trying my... I've written a few essays and short stories, but I've never written anything at length. So, yeah, open market, write a book, you know.
Yeah, I just feel like...
Win a James Beard.
The last 6 months have been equal parts, a lot of work, and a lot of celebration, which is starting... I think the combination of the two is wearing us down.
Oh, seriously.
Like, we are... It's been burning the candle at all three ends, you know. It's, yeah, it's been, like... It's just been nonstop. I mean, it's been awesome. It's and I awesome. Think for the first time ever since we've been doing this, we are actually taking a little bit of time to appreciate that while we still have a lot to do, I mean, I think we feel like we always have a lot to do and a lot more to accomplish, and not even accomplish, that's the wrong word, a lot more to strive for is probably a better way to put it.
Or achieve.
Yeah, we've taken a little bit of time, like, Mashama winning the James Beard was the most unanticlimactic thing ever. Like, it was exactly like as I would have expected to feel, which was elation and
relief,
joy and relief. And it was a total emotional release. Mm-hmm. Like, I just literally started bawling, you know, and I cried for like 2.5 days.
But I think for you specifically, you tend to, you know, you tend to push and push and go and go. Mm-hmm. And for me, I do tend to celebrate the little things. Yeah. I'm like, I didn't fuck up the order this week. Woohoo! Let's have a party.
And I'm always, you know, like, what's next? What's
yeah,
next?
And I'm like, well, I did, you know, we when we had the Eater article.
That was
you
the
know,
first time I cried over what we were
yeah,
doing.
Yeah, but that was sort of like the first time where I was like, yes, all right, we're on the right track. Because we kept gunning for those types of things or wanting to be in that conversation. And that was the intent from the moment we started. From the moment we started, we both agreed that our goals were very similar in the way that we wanted to be part of the national conversation. So, you know, having that article in Eater was just huge for us.
And, when they named us best restaurant.
Yeah, and so I was like, wow, this is amazing.
Did it make you feel like someone understood what you were doing? Like what you were...
I think, you know, having seen Bill Addison in the restaurant, I think he genuinely, truly understood what we were doing. Like, yeah. I think he... got it. Like, he had been there when we opened, and he even said this when he wrote about us. He's like, I thought it was good when it opened, you know, and that's what I thought about it. I thought it was good, but I knew that they were going somewhere. And then he came back and he, you know, he said, he's like, I get it, you know, and I was so awkward with him in the dining room. It was like, cause he came like 3 days in a row and I wasn't sure, am I supposed to talk to him? Am I supposed to leave him alone? And Michonne was just always like cool as a cucumber. And I'm like, Bill Addison's at the time. She's like, I know Bill Addison's. I ran into him as he was walking in the restaurant.
I was like, he's walking in a restaurant. I was walking out and I was like, what are you doing here? Because I didn't know him forever. And then I finally met him at a Southern Foodways conference in Oxford, Mississippi. And the first time I met him, I was having a conversation with him and did not know who he was. Mm-hmm. And everyone in the room was like an inside joke for everyone else in the room because, you know, at the Southern Foodways, you walk around with name tags, and he was the only one who didn't have a name tag on. So I was just like talking to this.
Though. Yeah, exactly.
And it wasn't obvious for me. I had no idea. So I'm just like, yeah, you know, so like food is like life. And he's just kind of like, whatever. And so when I finally figured out who he was and I saw him walk into the Gray, I was just like, this is so, I just thought he was like, it was so, I didn't even put two and two together, and that just goes to show, like, I'm just at work.
And I remember, like, I was sitting at the Gate 2 bar in the restaurant, which is kind of where we sit during the day and work before service, and, you know, an alert comes up on my computer, like, Eater, you know, the Gray, and I'm like, oh, I wonder what this is, and I read it, and I was floored.
Like,
he called
me. He's like, Mashama, Mashama, have you seen it?
It was true. Like, I was busted up.
And I was on my way. I was coming from somewhere. I wasn't coming from home, but I was on my way downtown, And I just kind of made a beeline to the park, to his house. And he was like, I'm on my way back. All right.
What other questions you got, Corsha? Come on.
Let's move on from this. Let's talk about all the times he's cried.
Yeah, exactly. let's get on with this now.
I feel like that points out a couple of things. One is, I feel like that moment is, you know, there's this these moments in food where people like to view, like once you win the beard award, they're like, oh, the overnight success of so-and-so. And it's like, this has been a long time coming.
Oh, yes.
Especially for you.
I've been cooking for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
20 years.
The overnight success of 20 years.
I know. Of 20 years. So I'm a career changer. Mm-hmm. And I went to school for psychiatry. And I ended up working in social work. And then from there, I was working in a homeless shelter, and we were doing sort of like these potlucks. And the reason why I started cooking is because people liked my food. They thought I was a good cook, and I thought, and that made me feel good. And that's really what pushed me to go into the culinary field, because people ate my food and they felt good. And then by the end of the meal, they were laughing, and we were having this whole dynamic conversation, and I fit in. I felt like this was a very comfortable place for me to interact with other humans, and that's really what started it. I wasn't driven by chefs or restaurants or anything. I was just driven by really just having company, you know, having people over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, you know, I thought about the gray when I was 45 after like a career in sort of entrepreneurship and media and the arts. And I feel like the gray is the culmination of everything I had done before that, because I was a lover of food and wine, like really a lover, like, you know, and the term foodie is not one I would ever hope to put on any person on the planet. But my wife and I just traveled for food and wine. That's what we did. And trying to build businesses, because what I did for a living, you fail, you know, 90% of the time. And when I decided to build a restaurant, it was here I could take everything I had learned about businesses and startups and my background as an accountant and my background in production, film and television production, and because the dining room's a show every night, mm-hmm. right? And you're basically, you know, giving the guests this very cohesive experience if you do it well. And I don't think I really appreciated how much of my life and my life experience was going to be applicable until the night we opened the restaurant. And I was scared shit for like 18 months, like mm-hmm. literally every night on the floor. I remember the first night I did wine service, my hand was shaking. Oh, wow. And like spilling wine on a guest, like, because I'd opened 9 million bottles of wine in my life, but never really, you know, someone who was paying us to do it. Mm-hmm. So like, I just think of myself as anything but an overnight success. You know, I just think like, oh my God, we've worked hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the best things in life you're not quite prepared for. Mm-hmm. I think all of your experiences come together to make you prepared for it. But even listening to both of you talk, it seems like you two fill the gaps in like your business partnership. Like, I think we were talking about last night about how you are, you know, very...
Yeah, A-type personality, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're, and Mashama, you're a bit more, like, relaxed and like, it'll be okay.
It's all going to work out.
Yeah.
We're not saving lives here.
Yeah.
It's just dinner. I freak out. Like, I have my moments. I have my moments for sure. And I think it's funny because... In the beginning, you know, when I would have like an outburst or a breakdown, and you know, Jonna would try to like, you know, well, you know, and it's just kind of like, you don't understand. But now it's now, and then vice versa. Now I think we have a little bit more of an understanding. We know exactly where the other's intentions lie. Mm. And we're very honest with each other. And I think that one of the best parts about this partnership for me as or really being open with my communication and really being vulnerable about my needs and my wants from this partnership. And once I felt like I could express that, then it was like sort of like, oh, well, then the gloves are off. So if I need time for myself.
That took a long time, though.
It did. And I remember, like, every time.
For both of us. I'm not just for Michelle. I mean, just to be vulnerable to each other. And I love the use of that word. I mean, that's really what we are.
There was a conversation that we had about a year and a half ago, and I wanted to sort of renegotiate like my initial sort of partnership, you know, because I really start to feel a oneness with the gray itself. Mm-hmm. And I was in tears the whole conversation.
So was I.
And
here like, we are again.
The entire that's number 37, yeah. By the way. So I was in tears the whole conversation just because I had to ask for what I wanted. It wasn't, it had, in hindsight, I didn't really feel like it needed to be emotional. Like I didn't feel like I was in pain or I was saying something that I shouldn't have said or I was embarrassed or whatever sort of sparks an emotion to cry. But I've never really had the opportunity to ask for what I wanted in a partnership or ask for what I wanted in a relationship, really. And so asking for that and him being very receptive and accommodating, it was very unexpected. I thought I was gonna have to like fight for it. I thought it was gonna get really like heightened and more emotional, even though I was crying.
The interesting thing about that meeting, which is exactly as Mashama describes, is it wasn't a financial negotiation that Mashama was trying to have with me, because you know, you start a business, it's like, there's, you know, you put the money in and you, you know, you sort of figure out the equity structure, which we did, you know, and Michelle has been a partner in the business from the beginning. She wanted more partnership interest, but it wasn't about the money. That was the funny part. It was about what she said, feeling this oneness with the gray. And she started, I think the thing that we never really appreciated early on is what the gray was going to sort of represent that was larger than food and what this partnership represents. And Mashama, and I'm, because she hates when I do this, so she'll correct me after this, I'll put some words in her mouth, like her feeling that she was representing all of the people who came before her in the South, and that she, in order to feel
connected to the, space,
to the
yeah.
thing, she's like, I want to be able to say this, I want to be able to scream it from the rooftops, because you really struggled in the beginning, even yeah. using the word partner or yeah. partnership. Mm. And I was always like, we are, and collaboratively yeah. and financial, I'm like we are. And it was that wanting to connect with it, which was the thing that was so emotional for the two of us, because we, you know, the financial part of it was easy. It was her expressing this desire to be connected,
to feel yeah. ownership yeah. you know. And at yeah. first it wasn't so, like the first 2 years it was like tiptoeing around, like I'm not sure what it means, like there's a certain amount of sweat equity and like I get a salary and sort of like, it was sort of like, what does all that mean? I'm not quite sure. So I just referred to myself as executive chef because those were terms that I understood. Mm. And even last night at the Luminary dinner, and Marcus Samuelson put me on the spot in front of the whole dining room and was like, go ahead, girl, go out there and talk about yourself. And I was like,
well, he called you executive chef, too.
And then he called me executive chef, and then Jono yelled from the crowd, partner! Yeah. And I was like, all right, yeah, I am a partner. And so still
the media doesn't like calling Mashama partner either. I don't know why, but they don't.
I mean, you know what? Also, like, I think the media just sort of is a vessel and they dictate what I'm putting out there, yeah. or what we're putting yeah. out there. And if I'm not owning it, they're not going to own yeah. it either. So it's really about me just sort of like owning that part, that partnership, owning it. And that conversation was, once we had that conversation, once I understood and realized and accepted the fact that I wasn't working for him. And I think in the beginning, I felt like I was working for him. And mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, I'm not working for him. We're working together.
We're even working though, for each other.
Even yeah. though he said it every day, and even though he, you know, even though he was very vocal and very clear about what he wanted from the partnership, I could not grasp and accept the fact that this was the role that I was stepping into. I still thought like, you know, I was reporting to him or answering to him. Yeah. And I think once I got comfortable with that part, that's when, you know, that's when we got more comfortable with our dialogue.
So you said that, well, both of you said that, you know, the gray is such an expression of you. When did you start to feel that and feel comfortable in that?
I think probably around the second year, I think. I really started to connect with some of our purveyors. And one of the purveyors, his name is Ernest McIntosh, and he's an oysterman and one of the most gorgeous men you'll ever meet, and strong, manly hands, yeah. And like, you know, he's just been on the
and
water.
His son is handsome, and his son is handsome,
and yeah, everybody. And so I think understanding, listening to his stories and starting to understand the coast a little bit more and the heritage of Black folks in that area, I really started to want to speak from that place. Mm-hmm. And I really just found it important. In the beginning, a lot of people of color rallied around me because they didn't see anything like me before. They didn't see a Black woman in a partnership with a white man in a restaurant that was grand. Like, the Gray is in a bus station, and we follow a fine dining, you know, sort of format for our dining experience, for our diners, and the food is unusual and clean and has very classic techniques. And so to see a Black woman at the helm of that, a lot of people were nervous about it, or they were like shy away from it. And working with people who help that dinner happen, who grow the food for those dinners, and understanding how they are the third generation and fourth generation person working in that area, that's when I started to really start to understand that I need to look at my grandmothers and look at my cousins and my aunts and think about the food that I grew up with and express it in that way versus trying to be, you know, Miss New York City.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that I think that from the beginning, we always, everything we do at the Gray was, you know, we wanted to be a chef-driven restaurant, right? That's what we wanted to be. So everything is in service to the food. The wine list is built around Mishama's style of cooking, right? That's why we only do Old World wines at the Gray, because we don't want to overwhelm Mishama's food with gigantic cabs and gigantic shards and, you know, American style winemaking, which I love personally. We made all of those decisions, but the Gray, I think, really is an expression now of Mishama and me and a lot of the people who've come through the doors, both on the guest front, like our regulars have helped to sort of shape what the Gray is. You know, there are staff members that have been with us from day one, which is rare in the restaurant business, you know, especially in Savannah, which is not a restaurant town.
That's
so there was not professional staff in Savannah when we started. And so it's really become, I think, kind of exactly what we wanted, which is an expression of everyone who comes through the doors, including the people who passed through the bus terminal, you know, back in the day. Mm-hmm. And where were they heading and what were they doing? And we think about that stuff, you know.
I mean, the Chef's Table, your episode is, you know, when you're talking about the oysterman, I'm thinking about the opening scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That episode is so beautiful. And I think that episode does a great job of explaining kind of the context and history and gravity of the Gray. Is it scary for either of you to run something that means so much to so many people?
Yeah, I always want to throw up, kind of. Yeah.
Does it feel like pressure?
It does. It feels
it
like,
does
pressure.
Feel like
yeah.
pressure.
Yeah, it is pressure. I mean, that's the part we didn't appreciate, you know? Like, we knew there was something special between us, like, almost from the beginning, from when we met. And I don't know what the Gray means to people. Like, I don't know. I don't know what Mishama and I, or our relationship, you know, but people come up to you and they say, you know, you're a model, you know, John T. Edge in his book, The Potlucker Papers, calls us a model for the New South. And I disagree with John T. in person on this. I hate that term, the New South, right? I don't know anything about the South. I'm a carpetbagger from New York City, you know? I don't want to claim any ownership over the South or, you know, because I think that's just wrong. But I think the South is really dynamic. And I think that it's having a dynamic moment. And I think that what is going on in the food and the food ways, and recognizing people like Mashama and people who look like Mashama, who are the people who basically created all of this, whether they wanted to or not, they didn't. I think that that's really interesting. And I'm glad that people are taking notice of it from a personal point of view, because I think it's an important message to get out there, but it mostly feels like pressure. Mm. It does.
Really beautiful, poignant pressure.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. I mean, I said this to you last night. I feel lucky to be a witness to it. Mm-hmm. And that's really fulfilling and rewarding. And I don't feel anything more than a witness to it, who happens to be caught up with a really wonderful woman doing something that I really love.
No, oh, that's nice. Thanks.
Yeah.
Do you feel pressure to cook?
I feel pressure to cook, to feed people, to staff, to lead. Yeah. I feel
to tie like, my shoes in the morning.
Yeah, I feel like it's hard to turn off. I feel like I feel like there's so much to do. And I think that people's expectations are so high for us. There are people who travel to Savannah once a year and they come back every year, and you know, you want it to be delicious and you don't want to read the reviews where it's like, well, the first time it was great, but the second time it wasn't.
Resting on their and laurels, you want it, that's a you know, recent one.
And you want it, you don't want people to be disappointed by what you're doing. And because of that, you know, it goes all the way down to the dishwasher, putting things in the right place so you're not distracted during a push when you're trying to look for something. Yeah. So I think that just the entire systematic development of how the business is run is pressure for me, because it's something that is very different from cooking.
And you're feeling that a lot right now, because Mashama's mantra right now is system.
Yeah, because I'm moving around and I'm not, you know, I'm there mostly, but I do see in the near future that I'm going to be moving around, and I want to be able to like take a vacation. I haven't taken like a vacation for 2 years. Wow. So I want to be able to like go away for a week and say, okay, I'm away for a week, and I don't feel like everything needs to funnel through me in order for it to get done.
Right.
And I think, because I think in those times when you can step away, especially for me, as I'm doing this and we're going into our fifth year, it's important for me to have some creative space. It just is. And I kind of never understood why artists or chefs or creative people need that, but I think you do. You need to eat someone else's food. You need to see someone's art. You need to, you know, smell a different air. You just kind of need to move away and be inspired through music or words or whatever. And so in order for me to do that, I have to prepare the staff to run in a way that is like I was there. Mm-hmm. So that is pressure for me right now.
Yeah, the last 5 years are not repeatable, given from the point of view of how many hours we put into the gray. Like, we couldn't do another 5 years like that, or we would both fall over.
It's just not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. It's not, and it's not fair. It's not, and you know what? The other thing that's unfair about it is that's the tone you set for your staff, is that we work 80 fucking hours a week. And so they feel like if they're not working 80 hours a week, they're not keeping up.
Yeah, and then it's hard to hire like that.
Exactly.
Because people are intimidated by the model.
Yeah, our reputation around town is that we're a really hard place to work for because we work so hard. Mm-hmm. And we pay the same as everybody else because the economics of the restaurant, that's my favorite review. It's like, it's overpriced. It's like, really? Come look at our books and tell me how overpriced we are. But when you're asking people to work harder, I think, than any other place in town, and get paid the same and get the rest of your fulfillment from what we're doing for each other, it's a hard, you know, sometimes that's a hard one to sell, you know?
And you're like, I mean, we're cool and all, but you got to work like 20 extra hours a week.
And they're
like,
for the same amount of money.
They're like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, the you know, this business, like I admire what Danny Meyer's doing at Union Square Hospitality and what the guys at Fat Rice just did in Chicago and how they're trying to compensate their back of house staff. Mm-hmm. In Savannah, we can't do that because unless everybody does it, then it's just economically not going to happen because we won't have any staff when we tell our front of house staff that you no longer get tipped. You know, they just will go work somewhere else. So it's particularly a hard sort of story to sell to, you know, guys who are being paid by the hour.
Right.
You know, it really is.
Right. I totally feel both of you on the overwork thing.
Yeah.
You know, as a freelance writer, like I had this terrible habit of saying to myself, if you're not working, you're not making money.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just
that's
not
how we both grew up.
Yeah.
That's how we clearly we all grew up.
Same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's like at some point it's okay to just to watch something on Netflix, mm-hmm. or to read something for pleasure, mm-hmm. or to, like, my husband and I just booked, like, an Airbnb on the beach for 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Like, and it's just 2 days.
It's just 2 days, right? But how long,
to it.
How long did it take you to come to 2 days, right? Like 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you grow up, like, I said about myself once, I just hustle. Right. That's mm-hmm. that's what I've been doing since like I'm 11 years old when my brother gave me his paper route. You know, like that's the last time I remember not working all the time. And when you're an entrepreneur, when you're a chef, when you're a freelancer, it's like if you're not out there driving business, nobody's driving it for you. Mm-hmm. Right. And you get in that mentality. And I said this to one of the guys on our team a few weeks ago. It's like, dude, I don't want you working like this. Right. I really don't. You know, and don't use me as your model. And I'm not, you know, I'm not going to hold you to that standard. I really don't want you to. And I want us to get to the point, systems, where, you know, 50 hours a week is a good week. Mm-hmm. 80 hours a week, 90 hours a week is not, it's not sustainable.
It's not the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're one of the rare examples, I shouldn't say rare. One of the few examples of like a business partnership that works really well. I'm curious if you both have advice on how to pick business partners. What should you look for in someone that you work with?
I don't know. I look for someone that you can, you're not intimidated by. When I first met John, I was like, oh, all right. I could talk to this guy.
She, like, described me as a nerd, which I've never
He was
really
very Orville Redenbacher. He had, like, the bow tie on and the glasses, and I thought I was going to see, like...
Here I am, like, you know, think of myself as, like, riding Harley Davidsons and tattooed, and she's like, he's just nerdy.
He's a nerd. I was like, he's a nerd. I'm good. Yeah. I like nerds.
There was two young ladies that came into the Gray about 2 weeks ago, and I could see they wanted to talk to me. Like, you know, when a table either wants to meet Shama or talk to me because of Netflix or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're opening a restaurant in Portland, Maine. And they asked me that very question because they were about to hire their chef who they were going to bring in as a business partner.
Wow.
And I think the best advice is you have to go with your gut. Yeah. Like, you know, I met, when I was looking for a business partner, I met 10 chefs. And not one of them, they were good cooks, like a couple of them household names. Like if I said the name, you would be like, oh yeah, that person. But none of them struck me as business partners. And the moment I saw Mashama's face, like, and it was down in the lobby that you just came in, this is where we had our first meeting, I was like, oh, I could just, like, Mashama radiates, like, you can see it. And I just knew immediately from Gabrielle's description of her, Gabrielle Hamilton, who introduced us, the chef owner of Prune. From Gabrielle's description and Mashama's face, I was like, oh God, I hope she could cook because I could so be in business with this woman. And that's just how I felt. And for me, it was done right there.
But you have way more experience than I do at those types of things.
And so. I made a lot of, I'm not bad decisions, but I've also worn out business partnerships. Like, I split up with a business partner after, you know, 15 years, you
He's
know,
a
and
lot.
That happens, you know, it happens. And we just went in different directions. It's just the way it goes. Mm-hmm. I don't think Michelle and I ever will, though. I don't. I really don't. I think
Too tired.
Too tired. Yeah. It's like, oh. No, I think that this one, I think we're going to run this one as far as we can run it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we will.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I'm a little scared, though.
But that's my advice. Go with your gut.
A little Sorry. Scared of what?
Yeah, what are you afraid of?
I'm everything. I'm, you know, Jono's a big thinker. And so I think that there's a lot of me me being in uncharted waters. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really where I'm a little bit like.
Last week, right, I don't know, there was an announcement. Fox Media did a deal with David Chang's media company. And I called up Michelle. I'm like, how come we don't have a media company? And she's like, will you shut up? All I heard was click.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's like, I come out of the media business. Why don't we have a media
That's
company?
That's what I'm talking about. If I was like to say yes, I mean, I'm sure he's already working, on it. But I'm sure.
Look out, David. We're coming for you.
But if I was to say yes, he'd be like, all right, great. And then I'd have like 55 emails already. It'd be crazy.
I mean, there is, you know, a new normal, it sounds like, for both of you, mm-hmm. where it's like this new, like, life cycle of the gray and your business partnership and opportunities and press and awards. And it seems like it's just, you know, an evolution of this partnership.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Like, it's like, it's almost funny, like I'm starting to get in the habit of saying things if I want them to happen, and they're happening, right? So I'm like, oh, I wanted to move to the South and open a restaurant. Boom, lo and behold, I'm the executive chef and partner at the Gray Restaurant. I want to win a James Beard, that happened. You know, I want to write a book, that's happening. So I'm sort of like, starting to not believe in myself or trust in myself, but starting to like
believe and trust in yourself.
Believe and trust in myself, or starting to think it. You know, think about it and like materialize how I can do it. Mm-hmm. Because for a long time, you know, and especially growing up in inner cities, you kind of are around people who are big dreamers, and only a few of us make it out, especially at a young age. Only a few of us make it out of that circle or those circumstance. And all along, you know, all I had to do was what I'm doing now. And, you know, there's a lot of power in that, I think.
I ran one marathon in my life, and when I started the training program, the first piece of advice in the training program was tell everyone you're going to run a marathon, you know? And I did. I'm like, I'm going to train for the marathon, because if you say it, like, you start to believe it, they start to believe it, they start to believe in you, and it happens.
You're claiming it.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And that's what I was looking for. You're claiming it.
Exactly. And I think that the other thing that I don't think that Michelle and I are ever going to lose because of how we grew up. And we grew up kind of very similar backgrounds in that, you know, like lower middle class families in the outer boroughs in New York City, you know, is humility. Humility is really, really underrated in this business and a lot of businesses. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of young chefs and restaurateurs start to believe the hype. And again, I'll go back to Danny Meyer. You're never as bad as they say you are, and you're never as good as they say you are. And you just have to stay grounded and keep your head down and do your job and find time for yourself. And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that we came to this older, you know. Mishama started her cooking career later than a lot of chefs. I got into the restaurant business in my mid-40s. Life has already kicked the hell out of us, you know? And so it's easy to remain, to keep your humility when you're sort of a little wiser. And that's another piece of advice I would give to, you know, all these folks who are going through, you know, this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the sounds of the
It's sitting right there. We just got the rough pours are up on the counter right there.
Well,
there's still work to be done.
He's like, Jonna just shot me a look because I still have a lot of work to do. So I'm just like, that's pressure. You know, it's like finishing that. And the release date was just moved up. So there's a lot to do in the next 2 months. Wow. And I'm hoping that, you know, I can, if my sous chef is listening, I'm hoping that I'll have the time to do that.
You're talking about Trevor Elliott or Trevor Morris?
There's two Trevors?
No, there's actually one Trevor. And so I got up and I gave my James Beard speech. And I honestly didn't write anything down. I just sort of had a bunch of people I wanted to thank. And I went into the staff just sort of like freelanced, and I went Trevor Elliott and Trevor Morris.
His
name is Tim Morris. So then like they're watching, they had like a party and I called his wrong name and he was just like, ugh.
And all of a sudden everything that was Instagram was hashtag Trevor Morris.
I feel so bad. So I have to redeem myself in some way, but I think
he will never not be Trevor Morris.
No, I think he's more famous because of it, especially in Savannah. Everyone knows who he is when he's like, oh, no one would be talking about you if she didn't say Trevor Morris.
So tell me about the concept for the book.
So the book is called Black, White, and the Gray, subtitled To Be Determined. We've been back and forth with our editor a lot on that. It's really the story of mine and Mashama's professional courtship and all of the things that come along with being carpetbaggers who moved down south. I mean, Mashama has a little history in Savannah, but I have none. And sort of all of the challenges that come along with that, challenges of race, class, culture, being good at what you do or striving to be good at what you do, and how this friendship and partnership developed out of it, and how we learned to trust each other dealing with all of our own sort of baggage and biases that you bring to any relationship, but a mixed race relationship in particular.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those challenges?
I think the biggest challenge we confronted was trust and being vulnerable to each other and knowing that we would be there for each other when we fell down. And a lot of things get in the way of that. And that's kind of where inherent bias plays into it. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I grew up in really white, blue-collar, Italian and Irish Staten Island. Everybody I knew was a cop or a fireman, and this was in the 70s, and cops and firemen mostly viewed the neighborhoods that they worked in as the folks who inhabited those neighborhoods as almost like the enemy. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to grow up in that and not absorb it. And it wasn't until I met Mashama that I ever had to think about it. Because to me, I was like, you know, a New York sort of progressive-minded person who lived in his little bubble. But I didn't know it was a bubble. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was a bubble until I moved to the South and teamed up with Mashama. And then I realized I was living in a bubble. I think, you know, that's been hard. It's been hard to confront and hard to deal with. And it's hard to realize that you're not as wide-minded as you thought you were. Mm-hmm. And that's been, I mean, we were talking a little bit about this last night, you know, and you're in a mixed race relationship, marriage.
Yeah.
And your husband had to come to some of those same things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was really glad to hear I'm not alone,
you know? Just even, you know, he sees the way that my earring just fell out.
That's all right.
He sees the way that I'm treated in certain situations, like even at like the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's eye opening.
I never had to witness that before. Like I never knew it existed. Like I probably would have called bullshit. I'm like, that doesn't happen anymore. That's 2010 or 2015.
But it's funny when we built out the gray. You know, and I didn't think of it as a race thing, but I thought of it as a woman thing, and I thought of it as, you know, just. Maybe a class, you know, no one really listened to me. Like, if there was something that I saw and noticed, like there was this PVC pipe that, PVC pipe?
Yeah, PVC.
And that went through the kitchen, which is an open kitchen, and it was plastic and it was stark white. And they were gonna leave it, you know? And they were like, you know, just like, all right, sweeping up the dust and everything. And I'm like, you can't leave this like this. We have to paint it or something, because it'd be so weird to walk in and see this white plastic pipe in the ceiling of this open kitchen. It just won't blend in. And no one listened.
They you would say something and they would look to me for an answer.
Everybody did that. Everyone did that.
That happens.
So it was sort of like,
I'm like, she's the chef guy, I don't know.
Right. Yeah, and it'd just be like, so I would have to call him or you know, defer to Jono in order to get anything done.
But when I realized I was the same way, that was hard.
Yeah.
That was hard. Not, you know, I'm not, don't feel sorry for me. That was a hard thing to accept for me personally. I'm like, wow, I'm that guy. And we've been through a lot of shit, you know, some tragedy and like at the Gray and, you know, Savannah is so black and white, that there's no way not to. I think for Mashama and me, this book has been really cathartic, because we got through all this stuff in an almost unspoken way. Like, we never really talked about race and me being white and her being black, other than sort of joking around and how people respond to you. And in the book, we had really, dig into it and really be honest. And like, our editor and our agent is like, that's bullshit. And if you're not going to tell the real story, then don't fucking write it. And unless you're willing to tell the real story and all and take ownership of the real story, which is another piece of advice we got recently, then don't write it. Nobody cares about you sort of glossing, you know, over the top of what you went through. Like, no one cares. And so we are, you know, really digging in and being really honest in stuff you wouldn't say out loud normally.
Does it feel cathartic for you as well?
For sure. Yeah. It was hard when so Jono basically wrote the manuscript. And he wrote a different manuscript before he shopped the manuscript. And then shopped the manuscript, and then it became a book about me and Jono. And once that came, then he sort of changed the whole thing. And I remember when he really was digging into the writing, he called me and said, listen, I'm going to start it with this tragic event that happened. And I was sort of like, okay. And then when he finished and he got all his feedback and everything and he turned it over to me so I can lay over my commentary over it, it was hard to read. There were some sticky parts in it that I was just sort of like, I didn't know he felt that way. And I remember those moments and I remember those outbursts. And I remember it being hard and emotional, but I didn't know that he felt that way. And so I sort of had to come to terms with what I wanted to say in those parts and understand and not be defensive. I felt like my first sort of go at it, I was very defensive. I was very sort of like, no. It wasn't, or what do you mean it was like that? It was like this. And I just wanted to kind of be more vulnerable and more honest with just being human and accepting, you know, mistakes, or really owning my position and where I stood in those moments, because I think that that's just being a human being.
Yeah.
So I definitely think it's cathartic for sure.
I think it sounds necessary as well. I think that with the gravity that's put onto the Gray and the story of the Gray and the location of the Gray.
Yeah.
You know, we have to have these
conversations. Yeah, for sure.
I guess we all feel that way, but I don't know that it, I mean, we'll see.
We will see. I think it'll be good.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be good. Yeah. I think the ones left standing are going to be the ones that need to be there anyway, so.
This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hotel and restaurant uniforms. Tillet is redefining workwear for the hospitality industry, ensuring that you and your team feel great from stove to street. Tillet is a full line of workwear clothing from pants to work shirts, chef aprons, jackets, dresses, chef coats, and more, with over 95% of their garments produced in the USA. Each hotel and chefwear collection is timed with the seasons, comprised of exceptional functional fabrics and built to last. Custom uniforms can be tailored for your restaurant, hotel, or store. Learn more at tillitnyc.com. That's T-I-L-I-T-N-Y-C.com.
So I have some questions that I ask every guest on the show about your relationship to dining. Do either of you have any early memories of dining when you were growing up? Were there any like dining traditions your family had?
Big night out for us was like, I can remember two things. One is like for baptisms, communions, and confirmations, we always went to a restaurant in Brooklyn called The New Corner. The New Corner, which was an Italian restaurant, and it was fancy, fancy, fancy as far as my family was concerned, and it was like a red sauce Italian place, you know, like, and so, and that was like, you know, my parents would save up, you know, to pay for that, and then every now and then they would take us to the Rustler Steakhouse, which was, you know, one of those kind of chains where you got like the $3.99 ribeye and the Texas toast and the all you could eat salad bar. And I remember that being really awesome. And then my father worked in Chinatown as a fireman. And so Chinese food from a place called Leon's. And then when Leon's closed, Wo Hop, which is kind of a famous Chinese restaurant now, but it was like, that was our go-to Chinese food that my father would bring home maybe two nights a week. And we would eat that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
For me, not so much when we lived in Georgia, but when I was 11, moved up to New York City, and my grandmother was big on food. She was huge. And she would take, you know, she would do dinner parties and all kinds of stuff. But for special occasions, we would either go to Sammy's on City Island.
Okay,
and
I've heard of
yeah,
this.
So we would go there for like graduations and birthdays
place,
and stuff like that. And then for just sort of regular dining, we'd probably go to Red Lobster, or we would go to Sizzler, and those were like sort of our special, you know, congratulations, you did good.
Yeah.
My grandmother was an avid shopper. Like her stress reliever was window shopping. So we would spend a lot of time at like, you know, those big chain places in the mall because, you know, we would get hungry because she would shop for 6 hours and drag us along, and we would just kind of lay around under the racks until she was ready to go, and then she would buy us, you know, lunch.
Is Sammy's a place with, I think they have like Henny Culottes or something?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
I was like Sprite or Coca-Cola.
Yeah,
Sammy's is the place at the end.
It's like a crab kind of shacky place.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to check it out.
Yeah.
I've actually never been to
City
Island.
It's
pretty cool.
There. It's
okay.
Cool.
So
my
cool.
mom grew up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty
nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
So another question I ask is, can you tell me about one of the worst restaurant experiences you've ever had?
Do we have to name it?
No, you don't have to name the restaurant, but you can if you want to.
So, I don't know if this is one of the worst, but it's one that I keep rolling around in my head. And I used to live in Bed-Stuy for a little bit. And there was this place that was sort of struggling, but it was this black-owned business. It was this young man who was opening up, who had like a health restaurant. It was like this health food place. Mm-hmm. And I would go there and get like smoothies or salads or a little lunch. You would have like just very clean food. And I respected it because in black communities, you don't always have these healthy places to eat. So I wanted to patronize it every chance I got. It was like 2 blocks from my house. And one day I went in for lunch and I got a salad. And the whole time I think it was, she was just having a bad day. I don't know. But he was sort of complaining about like not being supported in the community and not really liking cooking or not really liking the industry. And he was like making my food. And I packed it up and I paid for it and I went home. And there were like two rotten tomatoes in my salad. And it was so disappointing. Yeah. I was just so disappointed because I wanted to support this guy. I wanted to support just the act of what he represented. And he wasn't even, he didn't even believe in it in right. itself. And he was sort of making this food with these like these bitter hands, and I just felt really disappointed. And so that's sort of like I was one of my more disappointed moments in food.
I don't know if it's the worst dining experience, but when my wife and I were younger, we would try and go like once or twice a year to like a Michelin, you know, fancy 2 or 3-starred place in New York City. And there was a place, one of the great chefs on the planet, you know, had opened the New York City version of what he does. And we got in and, you know, it was immediately Michelin 3-starred. And it was just a really disappointing experience. The service was disappointing. The table linens were damp. Like it was just, yeah, it was just, and you know, we half the things we ate were really good and half of the things we ate were yeah. And it wasn't the worst experience ever, but it was the last time I cared about Michelin stars. And that was like 15 years ago. And I just only eat in places that I just really like, you know? And I think that that really helped me think about the gray and what I wanted the gray to be, you know?
Yeah. Wow. So from best to worst, do you have a favorite restaurant that you like to go to besides the gray?
I'm not a restaurant person. I know that's hard.
That's hilarious.
I'm not.
Oh, God.
I
love restaurants. I'm like a restaurant brat.
He loves restaurants. And for me, like, I never could afford it, honestly. And so I like to eat at places where chefs are dynamic. And, you know, I like to eat at places like that. But I'm not driven by that. And I feel so shitty saying it. But I can't shake it. Like, I sort of am moved by the people. I'm not in the food. I'm not necessarily moved by the restaurant. So I think for me, I think that I would probably go to like, you know, like, I don't know. I go to places like Prune and stuff like that. And
Prune is one of my favorite places.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite places to eat. I worked there for 4 years, and she really taught me about food and cocktails and restaurants, and it just was very reminiscent on how we ate as a family and how we grew up at home. And I think that's probably one of my my favorite places. I like Imputo. It's like a ramen place, and I really love there. It's like fun and loud and dynamic, and I love that. I love, I used to love Noodletown. I don't go there too much anymore, but I used to love eating there after work. I just don't have a ton of places that I frequent. I like to go and eat and experiment, but I don't have a place.
Do you have like a favorite takeout spot or like place you order from?
Well, it's kind of hard in Savannah. I don't do a ton of that in Savannah. But I think probably the restaurant that I frequent the most there is like Green Truck Pub. It's not too far from my house. It's easy to it's easy. It's relatable. It's healthy. I also like, who else do I like? There's this little Chinese takeout place that I just found there that I actually really like. It's called Cantonese Chef. And it's like this older couple, and they have their twin boys, and they kind of work there after school. So I think those are the two places that I kind of bounce back and forth when I'm not cooking. I'll like go to the supermarket or go to the farmer's market and make food or eat at the restaurant.
Yeah. I have a ton of favorite restaurants.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He should have went first.
Down in our neck of the woods in Savannah, or in the South, I think Fig in Charleston is one of the America's...
See, he's so much more prepared, because I really like
Fig,
and I go there every time.
Well, I do. I think it's one
of
America's great spots. I think they...
It's so much
Mike
more
Latta
prepared
is a great
than I am.
Owner, restaurateur, chef. Jason, who's the CDC there, just makes...
He's executive chef.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Executive chef. I apologize. Sorry, Jason. So I think that regionally, that's... And really, is one of my favorite places...
I agree with that.
Anywhere.
Really good.
I think my all-time favorite restaurant is a bistro in Paris, because I lived in Paris when I was younger, so it was a really formative time in my food life. There's this place, I heard that Bourdain did, you know, it made it to his show, and I didn't know that until recently, but it's called Chez Denise.
That sounds really familiar.
La Tour Montlerie is like the full name of it, but it's like an old school bistro, mm-hmm. where the woman, the rumor is that she was a madam on the Rue Saint-Denis, and she opened the restaurant like, I don't know, 50, 70 years ago. And the way she sort of gave back to the women who she used to run was she kept the restaurant open 24/7 Monday through Friday so that the working girls could come in and she fed them for free.
Oh, wow.
And that was the rumor. And they, that place is just, you know, up there. And then in New York, you know, as a New Yorker, I eat in places. I love, you know, there's a lot of places who are doing interesting, dynamic things right now. Like Prune is, you know, the reason I met Misham is because I was always a huge fan of that restaurant. And then places nobody's ever heard of, like Echo, which is where I'm going tonight with my high school buddies.
Nice.
You know, and it's just on Chamber Street, and it's like the Italian saloon version of like the Odeon. It's just kind of cool, and it's been there forever.
God, you know? That sounds so awesome.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
that sounds great.
I could keep going, but
he can. I literally just cut him off.
I'm literally a restaurant rat. Like I love them. I just love them. That's why I'm in the business.
I wish I had a better. I feel bad that I mentioned Fig. I love Fig, but I wish I had a better explanation. But I don't. I'm just sort of like I like the.
I really met Mike Latta, the owner of Fig, for the first time last week at the James Beards, and talked to him for like 10 minutes. And I was like, "I love your restaurant." He's like, "No, thanks." And he's like, "Thanks." I'm like, "No, I really, really love your restaurant. I'm not kidding."
Yeah,
he's also a very handsome man.
Surrounded by handsome people.
I know.
So my last question for both of you. If you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be, and who is invited? There are some follow-up questions to that.
Oh, God.
You go first.
Oh, I know. I would have my last meal at Chez Denise. Although the Grey really, it sort of factors in now, and I never used to think about it like that. But let's take the Grey out of the equation. I don't think that's
okay.
Fair. Because I eat in the Grey 4 nights a week after I get off work. Like, Michelle's like, why do you eat here so much?
So annoying.
But I would have my last meal in Chez Denise, and I would eat the frise salad, the pâté de campagne, and the haricot de mouton, which is chunks of lamb and white beans in a casserole that it's just ridiculously delicious. And it's comforting and... Mm-hmm. And they have a house poured brewery that they give you like a giant bottle of, and in a carafe, and it's just good.
Who's there with you? And keep in mind, you can invite.
I would just. It would be.
Celebrities, people. You can
yeah, invite. It would probably be Carol, my wife, and I think Mishama.
That's it. Table three.
Maybe Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe four. Bruce Springsteen. Okay.
But, that's very Jersey of you.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm really, you know, you can take the kid out of Staten Island, but you can't take Staten Island out of the kid.
All right, it's my turn. You know, I would probably go to, and this is going to sound real generic, but I'm okay with that, Carmine's.
Oh, really?
My grandmother, and I would invite my grandmother, who passed away right when the Grey opened. She passed away like 2-3 months after the Grey opened. And I was really close to her right before she passed away. And I had left and Went to Savannah about 8 months before and opened up, you know, went to start to open up the Gray. And it was one of her favorite places to go and eat. And so, and it's just really easy, right? It's just like just red sauce and, you know, super easy place to eat. And you know, the wine list isn't that, you know, I'm not going to say it isn't that good, but it isn't that dynamic. And, you know, it's just kind of,
it's not challenging.
It's ordinary. Yeah. Like, it's just an ordinary place. And she loved it. And it was, and I think she loved it because, A, she loved Italian food, like Italian-American food. She loved family style, loved sort of sitting at a table and eating with everyone and passing around and trying different things. And B, it was just loud and communal. And so I think that that would probably be the place because she would be with me. And then, you know, I would invite my cousins and all the people who sort of helped, who she opened eyes to. And she was very, she was just a, you know, a girl from Queens, and she really decided to not let that define her. And she became a nurse, and she was a private nurse, and traveled and ate out and shopped. And so I think she really did well for herself, and she exposed that to her children and her grandchildren, and that's who would be at the table.
And my whole family. Yeah, it's like, yeah, now they're like, you suck. Mishama loves her family, you know.
So, two things. Have you been to Carmine's since?
I've been to Carmine's, not since my grandmother's passed, no. Mm-mm.
That sounds like a fantastic event, maybe. Take over Carmine's.
That'd be cool.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And that's selfish. I would want to attend.
Yeah.
Are you drinking anything off the list? Are you bringing your own?
I'm probably, I don't know, actually. I don't think I was even into wine when I was... when we were eating there. I would probably let Jono pick out the wine.
Oh, I get to come?
You get to come. Oh yeah, Jono gets to come, yeah. And Carol.
Fine. It'd be a Chianti. Mm-hmm.
I mean, sounds
I mean, you're in Carmine's, right?
Yeah, in the basket?
Of course, yeah, like the wicker, yeah.
Yeah,
totally.
The old school, yeah. Gotta do it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I know you both have intense schedules and a lot to do.
We're done. It's Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should, you know, let listeners know we've been sipping on rosé.
But just a little. I mean, just barely a glass each. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nothing.
Yeah. No,
nothing. It's, what? It's happy hour almost.
Yeah, almost. Almost. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
It's happy hour somewhere.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank
really
you.
Really fun.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.